Hello and welcome to the Explanation Podcast, and today, thank you, Neil Gorsuch. My name is Ian Stevens, and I am a writer and a political scientist and a YouTuber. You can find me on YouTube at The Lucretia Reports or on my website at lucretiareport.com.
Hola, I am Silvia Salazar from Tono Latino, and I love talking about politics. You can find me at tonolatino.com.
And today we're going to talk about the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association. And to be perfectly honest with you, Sylvia, the first time I just Googled NCAA news, I was very confused because I accidentally Googled NAACP, and that's a very different organization.
Yes.
Specifically, we're going to talk about college athletes, or student athletes as they call them, and why they're not paid, and what this new Supreme Court case about that might mean, and perhaps maybe they should be paid.
You can follow us on Instagram at The Explanation Pod, on Twitter at The Explanation _pod, and look for us as The Explanation Podcast on Facebook.
And if you want to send us any questions, topics, suggestions, comments, concerns, or hate mail, you can send that to info@theexplanationpod.com. All right, Sylvia, do you have any idea why I started this episode out by saying thank you, Neil Gorsuch? That's not something you hear on this podcast very much.
Yeah, that was very interesting. I was a little bit confused, but I'm guessing he was the deciding vote on this? I don't know.
He was not the deciding vote because it was a unanimous decision. All 9 Supreme Court justices voted in favor. Neil Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion, though. Kavanaugh actually wrote a concurrence, which I think might have even been better than the majority opinion. So thank you, Brett Kavanaugh. This is a weird episode.
Yeah.
So if the NCAA and college athletics has been in the news recently, it's probably because of the recent Supreme Court ruling in the case of NCAA versus Alston. To give you a quick background, what the NCAA is it's the national nonprofit. You can't see my quote fingers, but I'm doing quote fingers around nonprofit. It's the national nonprofit organization that manages and runs and administers college sports, whether it's football, basketball, swimming, lacrosse, squash, or whatever other sport. Every college sport, Division I, Division II, Division III, they're all managed by the NCAA or the NCAA. And what NCAA versus Alston was it was a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court that ruled that the NCAA was violating the Sherman Antitrust Act by not paying their college athletes. The NCAA claims to be a nonprofit, but they make a massive amount of money. The 65 teams that make up the Power 5 football conferences, which is the most profitable arm of the NCAA, make more than $4 billion a year. The University of Alabama's football team made $164.1 million in 2019, and they're only in like number 7th place. The first place school, the University of Texas, made $223.9 million a year. And most of the people involved in this make a ton of money. For instance, Nick Saban, the head coach at Alabama, he gets paid $9.3 million just by the school. Plus he has sponsorships, brand deals, media appearances. He like coaches at camps and stuff where he makes extra money. A lot of the people involved in this are making incredible amounts of money.
Now, you said Texas was number one, but I'm guessing you're talking about money-wise, right? Right? Because Alabama shouldn't be number 7.
Yeah. Okay. Texas is number one in the sense that they make the most money.
Okay, I was getting a little confused there. I'm like, why is Texas number one? No offense to Texas people. I'm just saying, football-wise, Alabama shouldn't be number 7.
I do know Alabama. I have a lot of family that went to the University of Alabama. My brother did like a year at the University of Alabama. So I know from them that it's a very good team. I'm not going to betray my lack of sports knowledge by trying to quote what the reigning national champions are. I'm not going to try.
I'm pretty sure it's Alabama, Ian.
Is it Alabama?
This year? They usually are. At least lately, they usually are. Hold on. Alabama.
There we go. I was going to say Clemson. The guy who founded Clemson went to the same college as I did. And I think they won recently.
They probably were second.
Anyway, despite the fact that these schools are making all of this money, and these administrators are making all of this money, and these coaches are making all of this money, and these TV stations are making all of this money, and these sponsors are making all of this money, how much money do the athletes who are doing the bulk of the work make? The answer, of course, is none. Not only are they prohibited from receiving a salary or any pay, they're prohibited from receiving any benefits. For example, they cannot get gifts or discounts or free merchandise. They cannot sell their own name, image, or likeness, but the NCAA can sell their name, image, or likeness. Essentially,
so they have to pose for photos so that somebody else gets the money.
Exactly. Essentially, great. They sign a contract that prohibits them from making any money, but allows other people to make a ton of money off of them. And we'll get into how much work they're putting in later, but they're putting in a lot of work to this. The NCAA will tell you that this is like part of the core character of the NCAA, and that this preserves their amateur status, and that it would totally change the NCAA and college sports if you were allowed to pay athletes. And they also say that schools are mostly breaking even, or like not even breaking even, on athletics programs. That's a little bit tricky, though. The reason that that's a little bit tricky is because these schools and the NCAA themselves are nonprofits. And so they have to, on paper, show that they're not making a profit or not making much of a profit, despite the fact that they're making so much money. I said earlier that the University of Texas makes $223.9 million a year. That sounds like a lot to run a football team, doesn't it? So what they do is they can find expenses. Huge stadiums, massive coaching salaries, all of this, everything you could possibly get, extravagant expenses, and they just find things to spend money on so that they can preserve their nonprofit status. So they'll tell you, and on paper it'll look like they're not making much of a profit, but they could totally cut some of their hot tubs and pay their athletes a little bit. And so this has naturally made a lot of people very upset, who feel like this is exploitative. It's becoming something that the NCAA is feeling pressure to change. So getting to this Supreme Court case, NCAA versus Alston, which was a class action case brought by a number of athletes, this has really thrown a wrench into this whole system. And this is actually very similar to an earlier case, which was O'Bannon versus NCAA in 2014. And what that did was, that was another class action that was led by a former player, a former basketball player called Ed O'Bannon. What essentially happened, what inspired this case, was that they made a video game, NCAA Basketball 09 by EA Games, and they made a ton of money off of that, and Ed O'Bannon was featured in this game. He got no money for being featured in that game. And so he was part of this class action suit that sued to try to get more rights to be reimbursed for college athletes. And that one didn't go very far, but it did change it a little bit. What it did was, before that, athletic scholarships for NCAA athletes were only allowed to cover the cost of tuition. And this Supreme Court case said that they had to allow the scholarships to cover things like room and board and like other living expenses for going to college. Because a lot of these athletes, like, sure, they didn't have to pay tuition, but they didn't have time to get a job because they were doing so much with school and athletics. And a lot of them, you know, there were athletes that talked about how they would go hungry some nights, how they couldn't pay their bills. And this Supreme Court case allowed these scholarships to cover some of those costs in addition to just tuition. A few years later, come to NCAA versus Alston, and it was a similar case looking to increase the amount of benefits that NCAA athletes got. And there are a lot of myths about this. One myth is that it said that athletes can get salaries now. That's not the case. It doesn't say that, and athletes still don't get salaries. Another myth is that it said that athletes can sell their likeness, image, and name now, which is, that's not true, but that's closer to being true, and we're going to get to that. What it actually did was it allowed students to receive academic-related benefits like computers or textbooks. Like, they could give the students free computers, give the students free textbooks, things that were not covered under their scholarship or their living expenses, but that they did still need to pay for school. And once you allow schools to do things like this, they're all competing for the top athletes, and so they start doing things like that. And so a lot of athletes are going to start getting these things as part of their benefits. The reason that they ruled this, and the reason that the reason that they ruled this way and the reason that the District Court for Northern California in 2014 ruled the way they did in O'Bannon versus NCAA is because they say that the NCAA is violating the Sherman Antitrust Act, which prohibits companies from coming together to essentially price fix. And they say that the NCAA is price fixing for the price of these athletes' services. To quote a Ninth Circuit Court judge who heard NCAA versus Alston before it came to the Supreme Court, "The treatment of student athletes is not the result of free market competition. To the contrary, it is the result of a cartel of buyers acting in concert to artificially depress the price that sellers could otherwise make for their service." So do you get the reasoning behind that case there?
No, I don't get it.
Essentially, it's illegal for companies to get into a smoky room and decide what the price of something across the whole industry is going to be. Because either you can say that none of us are going to pay above this for something that we're all buying, or none of us are going to sell below this. So that's a way that what we call cartels like OPEC or, you know, the drug cartels are illegal cartels, but still cartels, groups of businesses that cooperate, that's how they can artificially make the price of something very high or very low, depending on how it fits their needs. And that's illegal. What the court's saying is that the NCAA is a cartel.
That fixed the price at zero.
Yes, exactly. The NCAA is all these businesses, all these schools that have come together to say that none of us are going to pay for this service that we're all using. And that's illegal. Even though this decision was not that monumental, all it did was allow them to get, you know, like I said, free computers, free textbooks, things like that. It really scared the NCAA. And the reason that it did is because of the way that it was written. And it left a lot of wiggle room open for further decisions in the future. Neil Gorsuch, for instance, who wrote the majority opinion, he wrote, "Some will see this as a poor substitute for fuller relief, suggesting that in the future, perhaps they will require the NCAA to allow more types of compensation." Brett Kavanaugh, who I said wrote that concurrence, he wrote that antitrust laws could not cover for the exploitation of student athletes. The NCAA really kind of saw the writing on the wall that things are not moving in their favor. And so the much bigger move was what they did, I think, to try to save themselves. They are now allowing for student athletes to sell their name, image, and likeness, which is like if you want to sell a t-shirt with your face on it, or if you want to sell autographs, or if you want to get sponsored by a company, you're allowed to do that now as a student athlete. And I think that the reason that they did that was because the white whale of all of this is student salaries. And they're trying to, like, appease people and say, we're going to offer this. We're going to let them do this. And maybe let's hope that that distracts you enough that you don't keep pushing for student salaries.
Will they get a percentage of sales of things with their name? So if you are the quarterback of the University of Texas football team, Ian, and I buy the Stevens t-shirt, will you get a percentage of that sale, or is that still part of the school and you have to make a separate deal on your own to get that money?
Each school still has a little bit of leeway to make their own rules within the guidelines of the NCAA rules, but they do still have the right to also sell your name, image, and likeness. So what I would expect will happen is that you will kind of be, most of this will probably be through other companies like Nike. You wouldn't be directly selling on Teespring or whatever, but it would be like Nike would come to you with a deal to make whatever with your name, image, or likeness on it. And you would kind of be competing against the school to get that contract is how I would expect it to play out. So the core question at the center of this is, are these athletes being exploited? Brett Kavanaugh seems to think they're being exploited. A lot of people seem to think they're being exploited. The NCAA will tell you that they're not being exploited. So let's go through whether or not they're being exploited. I'm going to do that real cheesy ninth grade presentation thing where I just read you a dictionary definition first. The definition of exploitation is The act of selfishly taking advantage of someone or a group of people in order to profit from them or otherwise benefit oneself. We have to determine whether these businesses, whether these schools, whether the NCAA is making money off of these people in a way that takes advantage of them. So let's start with how much money are these students bringing in? Because these programs are very profitable, and these programs would be nothing without the athletes. You know, people aren't going there to watch Nick Saban yell at an empty field, right? They're going there to watch athletes play. Business Insider did a whole study where they broke down Division I college football players, and they tried to determine how much wealth they generated. Obviously, some players will be more quote-unquote valuable than others, like, you know, the star quarterback will create more value for the school than a kicker, and some schools will have more valuable players than other schools because they're more profitable operations. For instance, the University of Alabama will have a more valuable team than, like, my Division III school that I went to. So Business Insider found that the average amount of revenue that each Division I college football player generates for their school across the entire Division I is $163,087 a year. That's a lot higher of an average at a lot of schools. For instance, UT, it was almost $700,000 a year. And at Alabama, it's almost $550,000 a year that each player on average generates for the school. That's a lot of money. They will tell you that the reimbursement they get is the scholarship and the college education. And isn't a college education so valuable? There's a myth out there that every football player, every college athlete gets a full ride scholarship. That's not true. Most get some kind of partial scholarship. In fact, the average scholarship for a Division I athlete is about $18,000 a year. Some students will get bigger scholarships, some students will get smaller scholarships. But also, the students who are getting bigger scholarships, they are generating more value for the school, usually.
But then there's also the private versus public school situation there. Because if you're getting a scholarship for a public school, even if it's full ride, then it's going to be less money versus a private school.
Yeah, exactly. A student going to a public school like the University of Alabama and getting a full ride will still be getting less money than a student going to a private school like the University of Miami and getting a full ride just because the schools are more expensive. And we totally didn't have to Google which schools are private in the Division I. That's not a thing that happened.
Nope. Not at all.
So on average, you're generating about $163,000 and getting $18,000 not in cash back. Already seeming like there's a bit of a disparity there, right? How much are these students working? NCAA rules limit them to 20 hours of countable athletic activities per week. But that word countable is doing a lot of work there. Countable hours that count towards these 20 hours you're allowed to do each week. They include things like practice, games, mandatory weightlifting, film review. Things that are not counted as countable hours include things like quote-unquote voluntary weightlifting, which the degree to which that may actually be voluntary is variable. Mandatory compliance, drug, alcohol meetings, things like that, travel to and from games, recruiting and fundraising activities that a lot of these players are required to do. None of those count towards the countable 20 hours a week that the NCAA allows. And so the actual amount of work that these athletes are doing each week is much more than 20 hours. The average athlete actually works between 30 and 45 hours a week on their sport, depending on the school and the sports. And this, again, is for the Division I.
So this is a full-time job
on top
of school. On top of school. Full-time school.
Exactly. You know, some of them are working more than 40 hours a week. The average Division I football player works about 43.3 hours a week, and the average Division I basketball player about 42.1 hours a week. But even students that are not in the super profitable sports like basketball and football, they're still working usually over 30 hours a week on their sport. Wow. And so you can imagine how that leaves very little time to actually use that scholarship money that you're getting. So they say you're getting paid with this scholarship and you're going to get this great education. My follow-up question to that is, all right, when am I going to get this great education? Because college is a lot of work, and to like do well in college classes is a lot of work on top of all of that work. And considering that some of these students need to have jobs still, that doesn't seem like a very practical enterprise, does it?
No. Well, and how much did you tell me, on average, a University of Texas football player bring in per year to the school? Like $700,000 something?
Yeah, about $666,000 a year.
A year. Okay. I just looked up the in-state tuition for University of Texas is $10,824. And then for out-of-state tuition is like $38,000. There's a big gap between that higher number of $38,000 and the nearly $700,000 amount that you gave me.
Yeah, like let's say you got a full ride at UT, $38,000. Say you're an out-of-state, we're going to make this the biggest expense possible. Say you get an out-of-state full ride, plus let's throw in $15,000 of, let's throw in $12,000 because I'm bad at math. $12,000 of room and board and living expenses. That's $50,000. That's still nowhere close to the amount of money that an average player is bringing in. And if you're getting that full ride, you're probably not an average player. You're probably one of the top players. Because they have to put so much work into their athletics, but they still have to maintain a certain GPA to be eligible to play, that has led to what's been called paper classes. Have you heard of that term?
No.
A paper class, and a lot of schools have gotten a lot of embarrassment when it's been revealed what they're doing with these. It's basically a class that they make for student athletes just to boost their GPA. So like a class that's like, all right, we're going to technically enroll you in this class so we can give you an A in it to boost your GPA and make you eligible to go out onto the field and make us a bunch of money.
Oh,
yeah,
lovely.
Yeah. Usually they'll do it in summer school classes. So like, say a student had a bad GPA in the semester, he needs to go to summer school to bring his grades up. So they'll give him like three classes and make them A's. And then that boosts his GPA up above the minimum. And so he can go and play, which is another, like, how much work is this college education that you're being paid with actually doing? Here's a really gross one. The University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. To give you a little bit of background on this university, they're the one that recently denied Nicole Hannah-Jones tenure teaching there and then backtracked on it.
She rejected them.
She did, which was, I think that's great that she went to go teach at a historically black college too. And so I'm very glad that she rejected them. They didn't deserve her. They also used to have a Confederate monument that stood there for 105 years until protesters tore it down last year. And what they did was they donated it to the Sons of Confederate Veterans, along with a $2.5 million award to the Sons of Confederate Veterans. They have a building that's named after a Klansman, and they have two buildings that are named after two of the men that led the Wilmington Insurrection, which overthrew a black city government in Wilmington, North Carolina. They are in a county which is 20% black, but they have 8% of their board of governors that is black. And if you're at home, I want you to Google UNC Chapel Hill 1979 yearbook and it'll come up. And Sylvia, I just sent you two pictures of the ones we're looking at. Would you take a look at those and let's see your reaction?
Oh, I was Googling. I was very obedient. Hold on. Okay. Let me open this up. Oh. Oh, Lord.
If you're Googling at home, you'll know what we're talking about. But it's two pictures for a fraternity, where they have two people in blackface making out and then a person in blackface being mock hung by some people dressed up as Klansmen. So that's the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. They have perhaps the most embarrassing paper classes. Do you know what classes they chose to make the fake paper classes for their largely black football team? It was African American Studies, and Swahili.
What?
Very poor choice, UNC Chapel Hill.
Oh my god.
So, we've established that these athletes are bringing in a ton of money for the school. And we've established that they are doing a ton of work and not getting the education that they're supposed to be paid in. The last factor I want to look at in determining whether they're being exploited is just how dangerous of a job this is. And I am going to refer to this as a job and them as workers because, let's be honest, they are working and this is a job. This is a job where you are really pushing your body to the maximum it can go. You're really pulling everything you have out of your body. Even if you're not in the top money-making ones, even if you're in one of the less profitable sports like lacrosse, you are still really running your body hard for a lot of the week. And that is naturally going to cause health problems, and that is naturally going to cause injury. Over 90% of student athletes report having been injured at some point. And according to a study in the Journal of the Canadian Chiropractic Association, athletes report on average 2 injuries per year. And 24% of student athletes have to retire early from these sports because of debilitating injuries that prevent them from playing the sports. And also keep in mind that when that happens, they lose their scholarships. Across the whole workforce in America, that's an average of every industry. So, of course, that's including people who are at call centers, but also including, like, loggers and truckers and stuff. The average rate of injury was 2.8 per 100 workers per year, which means that this job is 71.5 times more dangerous than an average job. So this is up there with all the jobs you see on those top 10 lists of, like, most dangerous jobs, road workers and loggers and Bering Strait fishermen and all of that. It's a pretty dangerous job. I think that a perfect, like, example of just how dangerous this can be sometimes was seen on live international TV very recently. Have you been watching the European Cup soccer?
No, I don't have cable, but I know what's going on.
So there was a player for the Danish national team named Christian Eriksen, and during the group stage, he collapsed in the middle of a game on field. And luckily, there were thousands of people there to notice him collapsing and medical personnel right there to give him a defibrillator and CPR. He had some kind of undiagnosed heart condition, and he had a heart attack right in the middle of a game, and his heart stopped. Presumably because he was pushing his body to the maximum extent that he could. And he's lucky because he is a well-paid professional athlete. I think he plays for Inter Milan, and he's probably a millionaire, and he's probably going to get a good job coaching or commentating after this. So he's fine. And also, he's from Denmark where they have universal healthcare, so that's a good one too. Imagine if Christian Eriksen was not a well-paid professional athlete from a Nordic country, but an American college athlete. He would never be able to play again, just like Christian Eriksen can't play again. But he would also lose his college scholarship. He would have tens of thousands of dollars of medical bills, probably. He would probably for the rest of his life have issues with his heart. They had to put a pacemaker into Eriksen. And he would have no workman's compensation, no support from the school. The school would totally abandon him. I know that they would, because this has happened in the past, and the schools totally abandon players when they can't play anymore. It's on you to pay for all those medical bills. That's on you. To figure out what you're going to do, that's on you. It can ruin your life. Like, if you get a serious injury that is one of the injuries that's going to affect you for the rest of your life, cost you a lot of money, doing this job for them, you're injured like that, making all this money, and they do nothing for you. There's no workman's compensation. There's no insurance. There's no benefits. There's no health care. They just hang you out to dry.
And you said it was 24% of athletes have a injury that ends their career, correct?
Yep. 24% of athletes have to stop playing early because of an injury.
Wow.
And so this is not by any means uncommon. So we were trying to answer, are these people exploited? You have people working in intensive, dangerous jobs, making huge amounts of money for the colleges, for the NCAA, for everyone else involved. But the athletes are making nothing. In my book, that is exploitation. And they say they can't afford it, but if you paid them 10% of the money they bring in, if you paid them a pittance compared to what you pay the coaches, compared to what you spend on big stadiums and fancy everything, you would be able to support these athletes. And you would be able to make it worth the 40 plus hours a week they put into it, the danger to their own health and safety they put into it. The way I look at this, you are drawing as much money out of these people as you possibly can, working them to death, and not giving them anything back. I think that's exploitation.
I agree with you. I mean, even before your explanation, I already thought that there was exploitation. But I didn't even know the numbers on the total amount of hours per week and the statistics on how dangerous this was.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of this job is to push your body past its limits. And those limits are there for a reason. It's when you feel the pain of a workout, that's your body saying, hey, be careful. This is getting into the point where there's the potential for injury. And doing that a certain amount is healthy, but doing that as much as they do it, I mean, the more you do it, the more potential for injury there is.
Yeah, I understand that coaches have to push their athletes. I get it. But there is this line where the push becomes something really dangerous and unhealthy. I had a boyfriend who was a college athlete, and he told me things that their coach would make them do. And like, if they didn't throw up 3 times on a run on extreme heat, then they couldn't come back. It was things like that that you're like, how the hell is this even allowed? I'm sorry, but if during extreme heat, you're throwing up 3 times before you're allowed to come back, like that's just, I mean, I'm no health expert, but this is messed up.
Well, keep in mind, you're also losing water when you throw up. And of course, when you're sweating in that run, you're losing water. And if you,
and this is in Florida,
really extreme heat.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's dangerous. I didn't mention this, but that same study found that 54% of athletes report having played through an injury.
Oh, I'm sure. Of course. They put them on like ice, or they give them some sort of thing to lessen the inflammation, and you go play. Go make me money.
Well, if you don't play, you're not making any money for the school, and they can't have that. They need to get all the value out of these workers that they can.
Exactly.
So the person that we're going to talk to today is very passionate about this. His name is Colin Bird. He is the mayor of Greenbelt, Maryland, and he is running a primary campaign for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate in the state of Maryland. And he is very big on racial justice issues. And this is an issue that he views as a racial justice issue because, like I said earlier, a lot of these players are black and brown and being exploited this way. So we're going to talk to him about this issue, about the way that this issue is connected to race, and what he would propose for it.
Let's go.
Unfortunately, Mayor Bird had to cancel at the last minute, so we were unable to talk to him. But I hope you enjoyed this episode anyway. Definitely follow us on social media. Definitely leave a rating and a review. Share the show with a friend. And next week, we're going to be talking to Sarwar Kashmiri, an author and professor, about the U.S. relationship with China. So definitely tune in for that. Bye.